This is the Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast brought to you by Art Wiederman, CPA with Ide Bailey. Whether it's taxes and investing or planning wisely, Art is the expert to make your dental practice profitable. At Ide Bailey, what inspires you inspires us. We provide a suite of accounting and advisory services dedicated to the total care of your practice. Visit our website to access our tools and resources tailored for dentists, idebailey.com/dentist. That's idebailey.com/dentist. This podcast is distributed with the understanding that Art Wiederman, CPA, and Ide Bailey, LLP are not rendering legal, accounting, or other professional advice. Listeners should consult with their business advisors before acting on any of the information or opinions shared. If you have questions and or feedback, make sure to email Art over at awiederman@idebailey.com. That's A-W-I-E-D-E-R-M-A-N at E-I-D-E-B-A-I-L-L-Y.com. You can also give Art a call at 657-279-3243. Without further delay, here's your host, Dental CPA Art Wiederman.
And hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast with Art Wiederman, CPA. I am Art Wiederman, CPA. Welcome to my podcast, and I am a proud dental division director for the CPA firm of Ide Bailey, and I'm located in Southern California. And today, keeping with our business topics of what we talk about every month on this podcast, one of the biggest issues that we as dental CPAs are running into are our clients calling us up and saying, "Hey, Art, I got a call from a DSO, and I've been talking to my buddies at the Dental Society, and, you know, I'm really thinking about doing this thing." So we've had several folks on the podcast talking about, you know, what this looks like. And my guest today is dental attorney Jason Wood, who I've known for well over 20 years. And Jason has been involved in well over 100 DSO transactions representing doctors like yourselves who are, you know, maybe you have $1 million, $2 million, $3 million a year grossing practice, and you're looking down the road of what to do here. Well, there is nobody that I know in the legal profession who is more qualified to have conversation about what you should be doing and what you should be looking at. And today is going to be a whole educational course on the legal aspects of DSOs and what you should be doing, what you shouldn't be doing. So we'll get to Jason in a moment. We are publishing this podcast shortly after the April 15th tax deadline, thank goodness. If any of you guys got surprises from your CPA, got a call on April 13th, gee, I owe $75,000, and maybe they're not a dental-specific CPA, and you're looking for somebody who understands the difference between medial and distal. I can't pronounce them, but I can say them, of course, and I do know the difference. Give me a call at 657-279-3243, or email me at awiederman, W-I-E-D-E-R-M-A-N, at idebailey.com, and we would love to talk to you. I also want to briefly mention, and we're not going to talk to Jason about this because I got a lot more important things to talk to Jason about today, is just be aware that there is this thing out there called the Corporate Transparency Act, and it is going to require you to file some paperwork with the FinCEN folks, which are the same people that do that take care of your foreign financial account filings that you do with your tax returns. And all I can tell you is there was a court case, and I believe it was Alabama, but what I'm hearing and what I'm going to tell you is you need to talk to your corporate attorney about this and make sure whether you have a filing requirement or not, because the penalties are ginormous. You just want to make sure that you do that, especially if you have formed an entity sometime in 2024, because for that, my understanding is you have 90 days from the date you form the entity and it is official to file this paperwork for a new entity. For those of you that had entities before, you have a little more time, but just make sure that you check that out.
Be sure to check out our new Eide Bailly podcast, Ebb and Flow, a business podcast providing inspired insight on issues and trends the middle market faces. Hear unique business stories, get answers to frequently asked and unasked questions, and understand business topics that matter to you. Available now on your favorite podcast platform.
Other than that, let's get into our topic, because I got a lot to talk to Jason about. I mean, this is a topic, folks, that is, I mean, we're having conversations, like I mentioned, with every single person that calls me these days. They're asking, well, what do you know about DSOs, and what are they doing? How does it work, and all this stuff? And, you know, we have shot down some deals. We have, for lack of a better term, approve some deals, but Jason is going to be the guy. Let me tell you a little bit about Jason. He's a partner in the healthcare dental law firm of Wood & Morgan. His emphasis is on business transactions for physicians and dentists. He works with leases, purchase agreements, partnership agreements, shareholder agreements, corporations, associate agreements. Sounds like he works with lots of agreements. Well, that's what lawyers do, I guess. Other business-related needs. I've worked with Jason on deals, both on the same side, and which I like working with Jason on when we're on the same side, but occasionally on the other side. And I can tell you, Jason is one of the smartest guys I know. He is really sharp. He's been published in many dental publications, including Dental Economics, the CDA Journal, The New Dentist, Dental Town Magazine, the Colorado Dental Association Journal. In fact, Jason is the moderator for Dental Town on all forums related to the business side of dentistry and helps educate dentists throughout the United States. So, Jason Wood, welcome to the Art of Dental Finance and Management.
Well, thank you very much, sir. Appreciate it.
Well, you don't have to call me sir. You can if you'd like. I know I'm a lot older than you are, but you don't have to, but it's okay. I don't make too many people call me sir. That doesn't go over very well, especially in my family. So before we get into the topic, Jason, I understand that you were in Washington, D.C. for a while in your prior life, and you actually were you worked for one of the speakers of the House in connection with the presidential and congressional campaigns. You wrote some legislation. With all the craziness going on in Washington today and all the gridlock and the Republicans versus Democrats and conservatives versus liberals, tell us a little bit about what you did.
Wow. It was a former life, it seems like. But I was an idealist. I still think I am in many regards. But I went to D.C. hoping to change the world, and I got there and had a great time. I was there during the 2000 election cycle and worked on some congressional campaigns for basically the Speaker of the House had this program that was designed to keep the Republican control of the House, and it was an overwhelming success. Basically, it was credited as keeping the House for the Republicans. And I mean, you know, I was 21, I think, at the time, and I'm trying to negotiate deals with like major power players, and you know, and I'm here telling, well, you got to pony up another $200,000 if you want me to say yes, you know. And so
is that extortion? Or you're the lawyer. Is that extortion?
It's not extortion, but it was, you know, that the Republicans actually had an amazing, and the Democrats then copied it after. But when Gingrich came in to in 94, they basically said, hey, look, we don't like how the Democrats have done the House and the fact that the chairmanship stay for 20, 30 years with the same person. So we're going to put term limits on chairmanships. Well, 2000 was the end of that 6-year term limit. So all of these congressmen wanted these chairmanships. Well, we also had a lot of battleground districts at play. And so the speaker was like, look, you've got a ton of money. You don't need it. You're in a safe seat. Let's reallocate some of your campaign funds towards some of these other battleground districts. And, you know, I can't remember what it was, 25 or 40 seats that we targeted. And, you know, it was obviously, you know, the it's not a set in stone measure where, hey, you got to give us 500 grand if you want the, you know, appropriations committee. But it was heavily inferred. So that was my first experience. And then after that, I went and I worked after the Speaker of the House, I went and worked for a congresswoman and doing legislation on, you know, small bills like Sarbanes-Oxley and things like that.
Little insignificant things that change the accounting profession.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I know. It's crazy. So, yeah, that was my stint. And then, you know, I wanted to go into politics. That's why I went to law school. And about 3 months before my wedding, my wife, well, my fiance at the time, she turns to me and she goes, "So, I don't really want to marry you if you want to go into politics." And I'm like, "I'm sorry, what?" And she goes, "Yeah, I don't like who you are. Like you, like it brings out all the negatives of your gifts. And, like I really like that. Like there's certain moments in your life when you're, you know, you have a decision to make." And it was like, it had always been my dream to go into politics. Love it. I wanted to help people. I wanted to do this. I wanted to do that. And so I really had to look into internally as to what it was. And she was right. And as most often, you know, husbands know, our wives know us better than ourselves. And, I was too cocky. I was too, selfish. I was too prideful, at that time. And so I made the wise decision of not going into politics, and stayed in law after I graduated. And, yeah, but about 10 years ago, she turned to me and she goes, "You know, if you want to go back into politics, I think you're ready."
She did not.
Yeah. I kid you not. She goes, "I think you're ready." And I go, not really interested in it anymore.
No, got this law gig that's got, well, first of all, yeah. And again, folks, a lot of the folks I have on my podcast, I probably get 2 emails a week from people who want to be on this podcast, and I'm pretty picky. I've known Jason and his father, Pat. We're all very, very good friends. And I happen to know Jason's wife, and you made the right decision, buddy.
Yes.
She's an outstanding, outstanding lady. Yes. And you got 3 wonderful boys. So that's great to know. But, so how'd you end up in dental, law? How did that, I mean, was that through Pat?
I drew the short straw on that one. No, I'm just kidding.
Be careful.
I know. I was going to go into the DA's office, again, trying to, you know, want to make a difference for the world. And, well, when I graduated, nobody was hiring. They had like California had freezes on certain governmental, entities. And my dad goes, "You know, why don't you just come work for me? We'll try it out. We'll see if this works."
Figure it out.
And then, yeah. And I'll tell you what, it was the best thing that could have happened. I never dreamed of going into what is in effect, you know, mergers and acquisitions, contract law. But he gave me a baptism by fire. So in my first year of work, I was handling actual clients and cases. And, you know, he was like, "Okay, here's a lease. Find everything wrong. Here's a purchase agreement. Tell me what we can and can't, revise and how that impacts." And, you know, meanwhile, I'm getting real life experience, and all of my other classmates, they were in the library just researching. And, you know, some of them, it took 2 years before they got their first client. And by then, I had probably had 150 clients by then, where I was in tandem working with my dad. And so I'm learning the ins and outs of everything and, you know, knowing how to just push enough or this or that. And, it was great. I mean, I could not have hoped for a better experience. And, you know, fast forward 20 years, you know, we started out pretty, regional, you know, Southern California, and, you know, fast forward, now we're in every state, and, it's been awesome.
Well, let's show these folks what you can do, Mr. Councillor Wood. Let's start with the conversation is, I mean, you're working, you told me that you've done over 100 DSO deals. And I know that because every time I'm talking to you and your dad, you're working on some other DSO deal. What does this market look like in early to mid 2024? I mean, from what I hear from the brokers and everybody out there is, I mean, every day it changes.
Yeah. And it does. And so I actually wrote an article last year basically saying, hey, with the rise in interest rates, you know, with the market's going to change. There's going to be people that are falling off. And I was wrong for a very long time. You know, the purchase prices continue to go up. The multiples of EBITDA kept going up. And I could not figure it out. And, you know, I just kept doing deals, you know, and as you know, with any equity deal that DSOs offer, there's always risk. And I just was, you know, would always tell clients, hey, you know, this is an issue. This is a possible concern, you know, interest rates and the fact that, you know, the money may stop flowing. Well, now in 2024, deals are still going, but it's starting to pencil out that it's even more important. And so I guess I'm kind of turning out to be right, where these fly-by-the-night DSOs, they're running into some money problems. And we're starting to see litigation. We're starting to see concerns. And it really comes down to the quality of who this private equity firm is, who this DSO is, as to whether or not you're going to be safe in term, I shouldn't even say safe, but whether or not you're going to be more secure than others as it relates to, you know, you selling or not.
And I've heard that there are many, not the majority, but there are many in the dozens of DSOs that are having financial difficulties because they, you know, maybe their equity partners have backed off, or maybe their investors, they're done with investor money, or maybe their cost of capital has gone up. And when you're talking about those kind of numbers, it gets to be pretty big.
Right.
Let's start this conversation now about, you know, a prospective seller comes to you. He's got a $3 million practice, $2 million practice, something like that. And they say, you know, I'm thinking about this. I've heard about it. Jason, you're the expert. I heard you on this Guy Wiederman's podcast. What do you start talking about? What should they be thinking about before they start this journey?
So I probably handle 15 to 20 phone calls a week on DSOs. And my first question is always, how old are you?
Yep.
And my second question is what are your yearly revenues? The amount of doctors, and please, if you are listening to this, the next 5 minutes is probably going to be the most important of your decision-making process. So if you are between the ages of 38 and 50, I spend a lot of time trying to understand why you are selling. Because the vast majority of the time, it doesn't make economic sense. There's no economic equation where if you tell me, I'm just tired of the management headaches and I'm 42 years old, but I love dentistry still, and I want to continue practicing dentistry until I'm 60, 65. There's no economic equation out there where it makes economic sense for you to sell at the age of 42 and continue to associate back for 20 years. It just doesn't, you could hit a 40 times EBITDA recapitalization event and it doesn't make sense. Now, why doesn't it make sense? Well, there's a small little thing called the tax code that Art, you are an expert in.
We use the tax code, Jay, in the same way that we talk about the Wiederman Golf Association rules. All tax returns are quoted approximately. Now, this is on the internet, so I may be needing a referral to a litigator or an attorney to keep me out of jail, but I'm just kidding. But so talk about the tax code.
So when you're, let's just play back and forth. When you're an owner, do you do you usually keep more money in your pocket than you being an employee?
The answer is, of course, because I run my own business and I can grow it and I'm not on a salary.
Exactly. Right. And when you're the owner, you also get to receive the benefits associated with hygiene, which as a W-2 employee, as a dentist, you do not. You get to be possibly more aggressive on how you spend your money as it relates to your business. But basically, at the end of the day, the tax code benefits owners and does not benefit employees. Now,
that is 100% accurate.
Right. And so, okay, 3 months, 6 months, a year, big deal. You know, we're not talking that much money. But when you extrapolate over 5, 10, 15, 20 years, we're not talking a few thousand dollars here. We're talking hundreds, if not, depending upon how big your practice is, possibly millions of dollars of differential because of the tax code, profits, and how that relates to, and then when you start getting even more into like compound interest, investment returns, and all these other things, it's obvious why Wall Street loves the dental industry, because
cash flow.
Exactly, cash flow. And so now you're taking a practice where you were, let's say it's 40% of profitability. So you're taking, and I'm going to use $1 million, even though if you're doing $1 million, I wouldn't recommend selling to a DSO, but just for ease of numbers, $1 million, your take home is going to be roughly 400 grand, assuming that your profits are, you know, where they should be and things like that. Maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less. So when I extrapolate that over a 10-year period, $4 million. All right, let's take that same practice as an associate. So still doing the same amount of work, but now in a practice doing $1 million, I, the associate, am doing probably, and I'm talking about GPs right now,
right.
We can talk about
right.
specialists in another time, but I'm doing about $750,000 in revenue.
That's now, about right.
And most of these DSOs, they will pay 30%. Some markets, they might pay as much as 35%, but 30%. Let's just use that. On 750,000 is, oh boy.
225,000.
Yeah.
That's why you have a CPA running this podcast, Jason.
So 225 grand. So that's $175,000 differential for 1 year. But we haven't even started talking about the tax differential. So we're basically double income when you factor in tax differentials, maybe even a little bit more. And now you extrapolate that over a 10-year period. Just in 10 years, that's $2 million. So that's why when I talk about age and why age is so important is because you're being told, and a lot of people say, well, you're anti-DSO. I'm not. I'm anti-DSO when it doesn't make sense. And there's two things. There's economic issues. There's lifestyle decisions. But you need to understand that lifestyle decision comes with a huge economic reality. And so those are the things that I talk about. And so, you know, we talk about age. We then go, okay, you know, what are your revenues? And my number, and it's not a hard and fast rule, but my number is around $2 million. Where
yeah, that's about, you can do it with a little bit less, but I would say yeah. $2 million is, I mean, I've talked to some of the folks out in the industry that do brokerage to DSOs, yeah. and you and I know them all.
Yeah,
that's about right. Yeah,
I'm a little bit more conservative probably because I do deals with brokers and they're around 1.6, 1.7, and yeah. So I admittedly am a little bit more conservative, but. You know, it's not worth the risk, in my opinion, if you're doing less than $2 million, because we have, at the end of the day, a portion of your purchase price is going to be based upon an unmarketable security that the DSO is giving you.
That we call it the mothership.
Yes. And you are hoping that that pans out in the future and that they go through what's called a recapitalization event. And so, you know, it could be 30, 40% of your purchase price. And so all of this has to be taken into account, because remember, we've got a known business where we know approximately what our revenues are going to be, you know, plus or minus moving forward. Yes, there's issues with respect to reimbursement rates and, you know, hygienists wanting more money and this and that. But at the end of the day, we can pretty much state what we're going to make for a long period of time. And it's, and the risk associated with that is very minimal in comparison to an unmarketable security, which may or may not pan out. And so, so anyway, so that's why for me, age and annual revenues is extremely important. And then the third thing, and it's more of the lifestyle issue, because a lot of people are being told by DSOs, because remember, the DSOs, there's a reason why they are spending a lot of money trying to get you to talk to them first. And the reason why is they're not altruistic. They're not wanting to be your best friend. It's because they can buy you at a lower purchase price with less protections. I mean, that's really it. And they want to be able to buy you earlier rather than later, because a young dentist in their 40s is going to be able to produce for a very long period of time for them. And so if I can convince you to sell when you're 42 or 44, because, oh, you know, we totally understand, you know, it's hard being an owner and having to deal with all the management and the headaches associated with running a practice, you know, doctor, just let us take that off your hands. Well, then you read the documents and guess what? You're still the manager. You're the manager of all clinical employees in your practice, and you're the boots on the ground manager. If there's an issue, you're the person they're going to call. And remember, you have an equity interest in the parent company or the mothership or whatever. And so you have a vested interest in being able to handle these things. So, you know, when I talk about these things, I'm sure people are listening going, wow, you're kind of anti-DSO. And, you know, I'm anti not being fully informed of people's decisions. And so I spend a lot of, you know, out of those 15 or 20 that call me, maybe 3 or 4 makes sense to sell. And I probably lose that argument 9 times out of 10, because unfortunately, what a lot of doctors think is that purchase price that they see on that letter of intent, they think that's the most important number. And unfortunately, as you and I know, Art, that is one of the least important.
No, it's not. And the why, Jason, is what everybody needs to talk about. And folks, first of all, if you're under 1617, you're probably not going to be part of this discussion. Also, if you want, if there's doctors who call me and said, well, I talked to this DSO and they said that I only have to work for 6 months or not at all, and they'll still give me the same deal. Yeah. And that's another, what we're talking myths right now, right?
Correct.
No, why would they give you all of this money and all of this equity or let you stay as a partner? And then you walk out the door 2 weeks later and some associate dentist from who knows where, no disrespect to them, comes in and you know, 50% of the patients walk out the door. So they're not going to do that. So I want to let's get into some of the lawyer stuff here, the due diligence. So let's assume, Jason, that we've now get past. And by the way, folks, let me be clear. Because Jason and I have had conversations, and I've had other conversations with people in the industry about this topic. I am also not anti-DSO. A DSO, I think, has its place. I mean, for example, Jay, real quick, you know, if you're a doctor in your 50s or 60s, you know, maybe you're 3 to 5 years away from retirement, you're well set, you can get enough money just from the cash portion of the sale, and you're willing to take a risk and say, listen, I'll buy into the mothership or I'll stay as a partner and I want to do this. And then I'm going to retire in 5 years and I want to keep working. And then maybe I'll cut back my management a little bit, but I get a real one well-run machine. That person could very well be a candidate. But 100%. I agree with you. And I've talked to brokers, Jason, and there's, you know, I hear them telling me, they're all telling me the same thing. The majority of the people that are selling are in their 30s and 40s. And that, like with you, blows me away. But let's get into some of the nuts and bolts of this.
Sure.
Let's talk about, we decide we're going to do this. Let's talk about what kind of due diligence should a dentist be performing? I mean, we're talking reputation, stability, tracker. I mean, talk about some of the due diligence that a dentist needs to do on that DSO before they sign on the dotted line. And we haven't even gotten the legal documents yet.
Yeah. Unfortunately, far too many doctors don't do that. They go with the highest purchase price. And I like I said before, purchase price may be in the top 10 issues, but what's more important is who is this potential suitor? Who is this buyer? Have they done a recapitalization event in the past? Now, just so you understand what that means that they have taken the collection of practices. Let's say there's 50 practices, and they have gone to market with either a private equity firm. It's going to be a private equity firm, but they have basically retraded or sold that interest to another company. Or they've received, maybe they were set at 50 million in terms of what they could acquire, but now that same company has received a $200 million recapitalization event to go and buy additional practices. So, The dirty little secret is that the majority of DSOs have not gone through a recapitalization event.
Right.
And that is something that is extremely important to know. And I probably could tell you the vast majority of the ones that have actually gone through. And there have been some that have gone through multiple recaps. When that happens, then you can... I don't want to say it's, you know, without risk, but the risk associated with it is lower because it's a known quantity. There is a track record. There is proof that they have been successful. There are some medium to large size DSOs out there that have not gone through a recap. And one of the reasons why they have not gone through a recap is because they do not have the infrastructure. They basically have purchased all of these practices all over, and they have never built the infrastructure because they have basically treated it as a holding company. And so I might have 150 practices, but I, the DSO, have never created the infrastructure where we are dealing with insurance verification, where we are dealing with marketing, where we are dealing with employee training and systems and all these other things. And a lot of private equity firms, even though that some of these people have been shopping for 6 or 12 months, they've come in and they've said, what are we buying here? We're buying 100 practices, but there's no commonality. And so there are, you know, groups and individuals that are trying to convince you that they can get 12, 13, 14 times EBITDA if you sell to them. And they've gone, you know, their date was maybe a year, 18 months ago, and they still have not gone through a recap.
And that's where we're going to see some litigation down the road. All right, talk to me about a letter of intent. So we pick a DSO.
Yep.
Hopefully you've engaged someone like a Jason, and I'm going to let Jason give out his contact information in a couple minutes, and if you want to talk to him. We've engaged a DSO. This is the one we like. We like XYZ DSO. And now... We, counselor, Jason, attorney person, we have to do a letter of intent. Talk about the letter of intent. What needs to be in there? What's important?
So, well, first and foremost, you need to know what they are proposing. There's two main models out there. There's the one model that basically you're selling everything. You're selling the entire practice. That purchase price may actually end up being perceived to be higher, because they are buying the entirety of the practice. But what you're not getting is future profits. The other model is what's called a DPO model, or Dental Partnership Organization.
Right.
And they are buying a portion of your practice, a majority portion of your practice, and you maintain equity in that practice. So you continue to receive profits after a management fee is paid out. And then when you go to a future recap, you then sell that portion of the practice or a portion of that portion, which that's a whole nother discussion.
Yeah, I mean, who do I have a right? What if I want to get out of it early? These are all the questions, Jason, as an attorney, right, you're going to ask right in this letter. So I know as a broker, I don't do DSO deals. That's another world. And those guys work harder than I worked hard in my career, but those guys are just, I asked one of the brokers who you and I both know, one of the really good guys, said, so humor me, what does it look like if an Art Wiederman wanted to be a broker in the DSO world? And he just laughed. He said, we don't hire anybody under the age of, over the age of 45 because they just can't keep up. And I said, that's good enough for me. I'm done. I'm not interested anymore. But it's hard work. I mean, right, you know.
Well, that person also used to be, he is younger.
No names.
I know. He is younger and he used to be better looking. But now that he's a DSO broker, he looks way older.
He's not as good looking. All right. So the letter of intent is really, really important. It's got to have the details of the deal. And it's really the letter of intent in the sale of any business is laying out. It's not the whole contract. I mean, if it's the whole contract, it's going to be 100 pages. But that's really important. So, what should the selling doctor be concerned? So we talked about price. Yeah. We talked about partnerships. You talked about the two different things. When you're negotiating with the attorney on the other side, what are some of the legal issues that you get into that maybe our doctors aren't thinking about?
Great question. So real quick on the LOIs. So there's also a few other things that are important. There's the holdback, how much of the purchase price is going to be a holdback, which is then predicated upon future revenues. That's a big issue. Another issue is are there future earnouts. So there's earnouts in other words, what portion of your purchase price is bankable, meaning that you can put it in your pocket, and what is predicated upon future outcomes, which you may or may not have control on. So those are the things that we really need to delve into, because I could tell you, hey, I'm going to give you $20 million for your $3 million practice, but I'm only going to give you $1 million up front. You know, those are the things you have to talk about and think about, because the reality is you might only get $1 million for that $3 million practice. So anyway, so those are the things that we talked about on the LOI. With respect to legal issues in the documents, and I will tell you that a DSO sale is extremely complicated. We do a ton of doctor-to-doctor deals as well. Still a majority of our business is doctor-to-doctor deals. I would say that a DSO transaction probably takes 8 to 10 times as much work, just because, you know, in a doctor-to-doctor deal, it's asset purchase agreement, you know, a lease, and, you know, maybe there's an associate agreement. In a DSO deal, there are probably 12 to 20 documents that you have to deal with. So you have the asset purchase agreement, you have the equity agreement, you have the continuation agreement, you have the, what's another one? A contribution and rollover agreement. You have, there's just so many documents and they all link. And the problem is that you may read the asset purchase agreement and you're like, oh, this makes total sense. This is, you know, I get it. Well, then you realize that the equity agreement is saying something slightly different than the asset purchase agreement, which the asset purchase agreement was referencing the equity agreement. And you thought in the asset purchase agreement, it was X, but really in the equity agreement, it's actually Y. And so you have to pay attention. Like when I'm doing a DSO deal, I have a whiteboard. And I still, even though I've done a ton of DSO deals, I still have to use that so that I'm making sure that the documents are linking properly. Because there's so many questions like, okay, how did you come up with the value associated with this equity? I had one DSO, I won't name them, but I had one DSO tell me that the equity portion, they valued the equity portion at $2 million. And then when I said, okay, well, how did you arrive at that? Well, it was an internal decision as to what the value of these shares was worth. And I said, okay, well, but how did you come to that conclusion? Was there a valuation done? Was there a third party valuation done? You know,
quality of earnings calculation,
quality of earnings, anything. No, we didn't do any of that. That's what we valued the shares at. And I said, okay, can I get a copy of your financials? Can I see what your monthly cash flow and all these, they were running in the negatives per month.
Right.
And so, you know, you're offering me $2 million predicated upon a purchase price of a unit that's effectively worthless unless you substantially grow the profits of your company. So again, you can do DSO deals, and I do them a lot, and you can make a lot of money if everything pans out, but you have to spend the time, you have to spend the work. And you honestly, at the end of the day, you have to have people in your corner that are basically willing to tell you no, because there are way too many advisors that they care about the fee that they are going to make off of you rather than telling you, you know what? This might not be the best deal for you. And I wish I could say it wasn't true in this industry, but there are few and far between, whether it's attorneys, whether it's CPAs, whether it's brokers, there are few and far between that have been blessed enough to be able to say, you know what? I don't need that money. It's more important to tell the client, this isn't right for you.
And I've done that. I've done that several times. Saved many doctors. So,
guys, well, Art, that's why I call you. That's why, you know, I wish there were more, and I wish doctors understood that there's not a lot of people like you, Art, at the end of the day.
Well, thank God for that. So anyway, but
that also is true.
So doctors, and again, those of you who've listened to this podcast for anywhere between starting today and 5 years, you know that I don't get any money from anybody that comes onto this podcast. I don't charge fees. I have people on this podcast who I believe can help my doctors, because my legacy is what I do to help the dental profession. I will have been a dental CPA on Labor Day, day after Labor Day, 40 years. And it's very important to me what my legacy is. And that's no joke. And working with people like Jason and Pat Wood and their teams they make me look good. So if you are contemplating a DSO, if you are in discussions, number one, do not sign a letter of intent till you talk to someone like Jason Wood and let them look at it. I mean, how many doctors, Jason, have come to you and said, I've already signed the letter of intent?
I said, I would say 70 to 80% of them.
Yeah.
I got two today.
Yeah. Signed the letter. And after they've signed the letter, there's not a lot you can do. But Jason, let's do this. If one of our listeners, and you know, Jason's law firm works all across, you know, all 50 states. So if you have a question, they can give you a call. What's the best way to get a hold of you?
My email is jason@woodmorgan.com. That's WOOD as in dog. M as in Mary, O-R-G-A-N as in Nancy.com. We also have jason@dentalattorneys.com if that's easier for you. My cell, 949-202-7900. Don't abuse it because there's a button on my phone that says dismiss this person. But I want you to be able to contact me. You know, because I get it, you know, 8 to 5, you're in the office, you don't want to talk. So, you know, I make Saturdays available and after hours as well. But those are probably the best ways.
Sounds good. We'll put that into the show notes, Jason. I want to hit a couple more topics before we have to call it a podcast. Yeah. So I know that every state in the United States have different rules. California is a little less DSO friendly than other states from what you guys have taught me. Talk about the importance of regulatory compliance and following state laws. Stark issues, anti-kickback, all these things that I know exist. And maybe also the importance of having an attorney who understands this DSO world, because not that your garden variety corporate attorney couldn't handle a deal like this, but it is really, it's a whole specialization. So talk about regulatory and all of that stuff, state law.
Yeah. So California, while the perception is it's anti-DSO, they've actually provided a very clear roadmap of what is and is not legal. So it's one actually the better states of saying, hey, this is legal, this is not. Another little known secret is that a lot of these DSOs and private equity firms use these large healthcare law firms. And a lot of them, those documents are not compliant for certain states. So I was doing a deal in California, and this law firm out of Utah was the firm for the DSO. Every single one of their documents was not compliant in California. We had a completely, and this was not the DSO's first deal in California. And unfortunately, in California and other states, when you're non-compliant, the government comes after you, not the DSO, because you're the one with the license. So we had to redo all these documents. The bill was $300,000 that this firm charged the DSO for the work.
Wow. That wasn't compliant.
That was not compliant, that we, our firm, had to completely make compliant. I mean, still to this day, I'm like, oh my goodness. Anyways, but that's not the only case. In Nevada, for instance, Nevada is completely different than California. And I was doing a deal with another law firm that used basically Illinois' version of the Dental Practice Act. And they were then utilizing their documents based upon how Illinois deals with the practice of dentistry. Well, the problem is in Nevada, you can't do what Illinois does. You have to be very specific as to what it's basically line item. You can only charge fees based upon a line item. You can't say, oh, we receive a management fee equal to 18% of revenues. That's illegal in Nevada. So I guess the point that I'm trying to make is just because they're using a large healthcare firm doesn't mean that your documents are compliant. And it's more prevalent than you realize. There are some DSOs that I can't even speak to an attorney when I'm dealing with these DSOs.
Really?
I'm speaking to like a law clerk, and well, they're not going to change that. Wait a second. We're in Alabama right now, and you're telling me that all of these documents have to comply with the state of Ohio, but Alabama deals with the practice of dentistry different than Ohio, but we have to comply with Ohio Dental Practice Act, and you're telling me that I can't revise this to Alabama? So there's things like that happen left and right. It's Stark and anti-kickback, that I always know when there's language about Stark that it's a hospital-based law firm, because in the vast majority of our deals, Stark doesn't even, unless you're Medicaid or Dentical for California people, unless you're Medicaid, Stark has no applicability with your dental practice. And the vast majority of the anti-kickback, again, It's hospital, it's Medicaid, it's government program-based legislation. So it's actually my little cheat sheet for when I'm evaluating DSO documents. And I would say 9 times out of 10, there's stark laws in there because that's the go-to, and yet it's not even applicable. So I don't know, just dumb.
Yeah, no, there's a lot. I got a couple more things I want to hit on. Yep. First of all, biggest mistakes you see. You said you saw 70 to 80% of the doctors that call you have already signed a letter of intent. What mistakes are you seeing being made in people doing these deals that are not
selling too young? Selling too young. If you choose to sell to a DSO in your 30s and 40s, you are making it's almost biblical when I say this. You are making a huge economic mistake. There's no economic equation, and yes, there will be doctors that say, oh, well, I did this and it turned out. Yes, those are called exceptions to the rule. But for the how we analyze things, if you are going to continue practicing dentistry for more than 5 years, it doesn't make economic sense. Another big, and I forgot to talk about this earlier, another big thing is if you have two offers and they're the same purchase price, but one DSO just went through a recap and one DSO is going to go through a recap in 12 months, which one should you go with?
Probably the one that's about to go through a recap. Exactly. And make sure that you're getting into the deal in enough time that you're going to be part of that recap, right, Jason?
Correct. And you have to make sure it's documented in the documents. Otherwise, you might not be in that.
Well, wait a minute. You told me I was going to be part of this. Now I'm not, and I'm going to be sad and cry out of both eyes. There you go.
Exactly.
One more thing. Now, you and I have talked about this. There are, we'll call them buy-side advisors and people that are doing the roll-ups and companies that are saying, oh, well, we're putting together, and you mentioned this a little earlier, you know, 200, 500, 1 million practices, and we're going to get you 72 times EBITDA times 12 times pi divided by the sky. And you and I have had these conversations. Why should we be concerned, and what should dentists know about these companies, again, obviously no names, about these groups that they should be concerned about?
No names, huh?
Be careful. Jason, no names.
They are all charlatans. They are snake oil salesmen. They are the bane of existence. I mean, I cannot stress this enough. There are people out there who are promising. They're either using their dental license to trick you. They're using their consulting companies to trick you. Into promising you the moon, that we're all going to band together and we're going to sell to, you know, private equity and this and that. One, it has not happened. Okay. Two, have you ever looked at the fees that they charge? The fees that they charge associated with these roll-ups eats up every possible profit that you would receive selling to a DSO. And none of them have hit their days for when they were supposed to recap. And by the way, once you sign with them, you have contracts that are non-cancelable, meaning that you are in litigation.
You're bound.
Try. Yes. So please, someone selling you something that sounds too good to be true, guess what? It is.
Yeah.
I wish I could name names, but
no, you can't. No,
I know.
No, bad dog. Stop.
I know.
No, you can't.
They are not.
Okay. We had this discussion. If you name names, you get a timeout. You understand?
I know.
Okay. But the bottom line, folks, you know, joking aside, is if you are looking at going down the road, you want to look at the why. And if you're going to go down this road, you need a CPA firm that knows what these deals look like, We do this at iBailey. In fact, we have a whole group at iBailey that does nothing but quality of earnings. And, you know, we've been through in our Tustin office, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 of these deals or clients that have come to us and they want us to look at them. So they're all different. But at the end of the day, it's a very, very complicated deal. And if people, and there's a lot, and that's the thing, is there's a lot of money to be made by people who are going to take your life's work and put it at risk, potentially. But on the other hand, there are some really, really good DSOs who do good things and have been successful and have been through recapitalizations and have made their doctors millions of dollars. That's true too, right, Jason?
Absolutely. And that's the hard part, is knowing who the good ones are and who the bad ones are.
And when you're working with someone like a Jason or someone like, you know, some of the brokers out there that we work with, they know everybody. And again, last thing is your opinion. I mean, working with, you know, someone like yourself or DSO broker, they know all the DSOs. And what happens, we see, is that the doctors get offers and the DSOs bank on the fact, I've been told, that as much as 70% of the doctors are going to buy, are going to sell at a much lower price, which means that when a broker or a Jason or an Art get involved in this thing, they can pay fair market because they're making it back on the 70% of the folks that just signed on the dotted line. Is that an accurate statement?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would say the majority of people that come to me are doing it on their own. They are very proud of the purchase price they were able to negotiate, you know, and the reason why they reached out directly to the DSO or the DSO contacted them, and they're ecstatic at the purchase price they received. Well, not a single one has ever come close to a purchase price that I've seen certain DSO brokers be able to achieve. Now, that's another thing, though, is that there are a lot of brokers out there who claim that they're experts in DSOs and this and that, and I have not seen the value. So knowing who the good ones are and who the not so good ones are is another big issue.
It's like you, doctor. You know, you do great crowns and great occlusion and great smile designs, but if you're going to get into specialty work, you better know what you're doing. I am a dental practice broker. I have been for 20 years. Jason knows that. Would Jason refer me a deal to sell to a DSO? He shouldn't, because that's not my area of expertise. I bring in people that I know that do this, because I don't know. There's somewhere between 500 and 1,000 DSOs, depending on who you talk to, and they're all different. And if you don't work with them on a daily basis, you know, I mean, a broker who just, well, how many DSO deals have you done? One. Oh, really? Well, we didn't really get that one done, but I've worked with one. I understand how it worked now. So anyway, I would love to continue this conversation for days, because you and I could go through a lot more, but you have been an absolute joy to talk to, and you have a lot of knowledge. And again, you know, it's fun when I get to talk to my friends in the industry on this. One more time, Jason, give out your contact information and then stay with me as I take the podcast out.
You got it. Jason@dentalattorneys.com or Jason@woodmorgan.com. My cell, 949-202-7900. Try not to abuse it, but I do enjoy talking to you guys. So,
well, and again, you know, I would encourage you, if you are thinking about it, again, just the one piece of advice, and I'm not a licensed attorney, but I can give this advice. Do not sign a letter of intent with any DSO unless someone like Jason Wood has looked at it. So anyway, Jay, hang on with us.
I guess I should have said, I mean, I don't even charge people to look at the LOI. So, you know, that's how I want to be involved in the process, because I want to be able to help. So anyway.
Okay. No, well, you are. So that's good. So right. Everyone, I did forget, I may not end up in prison over this, I did forget to thank our wonderful marketing partner, Decisions in Dentistry Magazine, at the beginning of the podcast, www.decisionsindentistry.com. They have 140 incredible CE courses available at a very reasonable price, and they also have 3 live video courses that yours truly, Art Wiederman, has done on Art's Golden Rules of Financial Planning, Metrics, and also Retirement Planning. Please go to their website, www.decisionsindentistry.com. If you are looking for a new dental CPA a new CPA who happens to be a dental CPA and you're not working with one, we've got you covered. Ide Bailey works with over 1,000 dentists in all of our offices in the Western United States. In our office in Tustin, we work with, I think, 250 practices, maybe more. I don't even remember what the last count was. Please give me a call if you have any questions about anything, 657-279-3243. I, too, will chat with you complimentary to listen to what your concerns are and to see if we can help you. Send me an email at awiederman, W-I-E-D-E-R-M-A-N, at idebailey.com. I'm also a member of the Academy of Dental CPAs, www.adcpa.org, which is 26 CPA firms across the country, and we represent over 11,000 dentists. So there's a lot of us out there that do the work, and we know what we're doing. Jason Wood, thank you so much for your time and your expertise, and thank you, I look forward to working with you in the future. And folks, just promise me Jason or somebody else, just promise me that when you start or you think about starting this journey, get some good professional advice. Talk to a CPA, talk to an attorney, talk to a DSO broker who's been down this road. If you need referrals, I can certainly give them to you before you do anything, because you could make the biggest financial mistake of your life. And unfortunately, we've seen it happen, and sometimes it's too late. So, with that said, folks, I want to thank you all for the honor and the privilege of your time, and I hope you'll tell your friends all about my podcast, and I hope you'll subscribe to it on your your Apple or your Android or whatever podcast methodology you use to listen to podcasts. And with that, that is it for this edition of The Art of Dental Finance and Management with Art Wiederman, CPA. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of The Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. The Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast is produced by Ide Bailey in partnership with Art Wiederman, CPA, Decisions in Dentistry Magazine, and the Academy of Dental CPAs. For audience questions and feedback, email Art Wiederman, awiederman@idebailey.com. That's awiederman at idebailey.com. Or you may call Art at 657-279-3243.